Judging from the defense authorization bills that have passed the House and been marked up in the Senate, Congress seems to have made a hash out of Pentagon plans to meet its budgetary goals. Todd Harrison is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He joins us now to help sort out the reality of where defense spending is headed and who will benefit. Todd, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so whatever happened to sequestration and the 10-year plan to reduce the growth in the Pentagon's budget? That seems to be all gone now.
Well, it's still there. It's still in effect. It's been amended twice. And so what Congress has done is for 2013, 2014, and fiscal year 15, they have raised the budget caps above where they were initially set. So the cuts have not been quite as steep as they were initially planned to be. For 2016 and beyond, the original budget caps remain in effect. So, you know, that is still looming out in front of the Pentagon. But, you know, part of the reason that we haven't started to see a lot of the pain yet is because Congress has not been allowing DOD to make the cuts that it's going to need to make in order to fit within these budget constraints in the long run. And so instead, Congress has been forcing DOD to do, you know, tricky budget maneuvers to absorb the cuts in the near term without having long-term consequences. So, you know, good examples of that are in this year's Authorization Act that's working its way through the House and the Senate. They didn't allow DOD to do things like compensation reform. They didn't allow them to retire some old weapon systems, things like the A-10 aircraft. And when Congress prevents those moves, DOD still has to cut the money, but they have to cut it out of places that are less visible, but, you know, just as bad, and perhaps much worse. They're having to take it out of training. They're having to take it out of maintenance of equipment. And so what that means is our forces won't be as ready if they're called upon to fight in the near term.
Todd, it almost seems like Congress is trying to pull the wool over its own eyes then, and the Pentagon is staring into, you know, what's ahead in 2016 and beyond, trying to be practical in the short term so that the pain is less in the long term, and Congress refuses to see that. Is it just because it's an election year, or is there something else going on?
Well, part of it is because it's an election year, and Congress is certainly in denial about the situation they've set up with these budget caps and the long-term consequences. They're not willing to make the hard choices to fit within the budget constraints that they've put on DOD and other government agencies as well that are subject to sequestration. So, you know, I think there's a lot of denial going on. Part of it, too, is just the way the system is set up is that DOD has to submit a 5-year budget every year to Congress. Congress only has to act on the first year of that budget. And, you know, a lot of these smart reductions you can make, like retiring legacy weapon systems that the department, you know, thinks are a lower priority, it doesn't really need anymore, given the budget constraints it has. A lot of those things, they don't save you much money in the first year. So Congress can deny those requests, and it doesn't actually make that big of a difference in the first year of the budget. But over 5 years, those savings really add up.
So can you look at these budget ideas or these authorization ideas, which presumably get translated into an appropriation? Is there any discernible, I don't know, philosophy toward what national defense should be in there? I mean, the administration was talking about a few things like the swing toward the Pacific and also greater use of special forces as opposed to large, you know, ground forces and maybe funding of a few goodies like the F-35 and maybe a new long-range bomber. But the rest of the stuff goes away. That was at least the sketch of a philosophy. Is there one now in the House or the Senate?
Yeah, I have to say that it looks like it's a strategy of denial. That there's not, you know, a lot of these decisions, they aren't based on any kind of overarching, you know, view of the world, the threat environment, how the U.S. Is going to operate in that future environment. I don't really see that. I see these as very short-term, in many cases, politically focused decisions that Congress is just simply in denial. They don't want to have to face up to the hard decisions here. You know, the reality of the matter is when you cut the defense budget, you have to cut something, and Congress has not really owned up to that yet.
So the White House is threatening to veto the version that's passed the House. Is this really a sort of a must-pass bill?
You know, it usually is a must-pass piece of legislation, but you also should note the veto threat was not the highest level of veto threat. The wording that they used was that the president's senior advisors would recommend that he veto this bill. The highest threat is when the president says, I will veto this bill. So it's not the full-on veto threat. And I think, you know, this has become customary in some sense that, you know, you see these threats in the initial authorization bills. But by the time the Senate passes theirs and they go to conference committee and they come out with one bill, you know, the White House is still not going to like a lot of things that are in there, but they'll probably have no choice but to go along with it.
So is this really a sign that, okay, fine, we'll grit our teeth and have the president sign it?
Yeah, so because they didn't use the highest level of veto threat, they're not really, you know, staking a lot of credibility on this.
Interesting. We're speaking with Todd Harrison. He's senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And just looking at one analysis here from someone who watches weapons systems in particular, it looks like almost nothing is really getting thrown out the window here.
Well, you know, and that's kind of the disturbing part of it is, you know, when you're making budget reductions, you know, something's got to give. And so if they're not letting DOD, you know, cut back on acquisitions, if they're not letting them cut back on legacy weapon systems, retiring those, they're not letting them reform compensation, they're not letting them close excess bases, what's going to give? And, you know, the slush fund, if you will, the money that you can always pull a little more out of is training and maintenance. And so I think that that's really, you know, the default here is that this money is going to come out of training and maintenance.
And how do you expect the bill to change or be shaped as it goes through the Senate process and eventually to conference?
You know, there are a few differences between the House and the Senate bills that we're seeing so far. I believe the Senate bill is allowing a bit more of the compensation reform than the House did. The Senate would allow the department to reduce the allowance for housing. I should say reduce the increase in the allowance for housing, slow the growth. And I think that we're going to allow a few more of the TRICARE changes, but not much. So, you know, what we'll look for is in the conference committee, where do they compromise between the House and the Senate and what actually makes it in there? But, you know, a lot of the big issues like retiring the A-10, you know, continuing with the Joint Strike Fighter program, you know, continuing with a lot of the major programs that are in there, there's really no difference between the House and the Senate on a lot of these big issues. So I don't think we're going to see, you know, a dramatically different bill that comes out of conference committee.
Now, is there any way that the Pentagon can kind of secretly compensate? I'm looking at, to say, Jim McAleese's assessment and says, okay, the EA-18G Growler is fully funded. Okay, so whatever that is, it's a plane, and it's been made for a number of years, which means they have to buy a certain number. Can they somehow stretch out the deliveries and use some of the money for training? Because you have to have people trained to fly the thing, otherwise it just sits there.
Yeah,
or would the contractor go running to Congress and say, they're not buying all they're supposed to?
Well, yeah, so the way Congress appropriates the money, funding for procurement of the, you know, the growlers, that's in a procurement funding line that's designated specifically for that program. So you can't spend it on anything else unless you use a reprogramming authority, which has to go back. It's subject to dollar limits on how much you can reprogram from one account to another, and it still has to go back and get the sign-off of the four big committees in the House and the Senate.
But you could probably reasonably estimate that the cost of training for all of them is probably equal to the price of one of them.
Yeah, so the training is a big part of it. Now, with the growlers, that's an interesting one because if that is not funded, if they don't fund the continued production of the growlers, then that production line is going to shut down soon, and then the Navy will not have an option to buy a plane like that. The only option from that point forward would be the F-35. And, of course, the F-35 has run into problems over the years and schedule delays and cost overruns. So that is something that, you know, I think Congress and the Navy, too, probably would like to keep that production line open so they have that other option to keep the pressure on the F-35 program.
You know, we could say that many lawmakers are probably thinking short term, but there are certainly those on the Armed Services Committees that are grappling with the future of the U.S. military with all the changes in the geopolitical scene and to the budget. Are they going to have a debate with the Pentagon about what the military should look like in the long term, given the fact that they are so far apart on this particular bill?
You know, they are, and there are good discussions going on, and, you know, we should always be careful not to paint Congress with too broad of a brush. you know, there are members in both, you know, the House and the Senate on the Armed Services Committee who are having a really good debate and discussion about what the future of the U.S. military should be. And, you know, looking at, you know, what's the future of air power? What's the future of sea power? What's the future of land power? How are we going to operate in all these domains? They're looking at the space domain. They're looking at the cyber domain. And I think there really is a rich debate there. And, you know, it doesn't get a lot of attention because it's not a partisan debate. You know, it's a debate where there actually is a lot of agreement between Democrats and Republicans on what the future of the military should look like. The problem is translating that into legislation. And, you know, all of the – when you think about what the future of the military should look like, you usually start with thinking, okay, well, what are the things that I'll need in the future that I don't have right now? And so those are things you want to add to the budget. But, you know, in this budget environment, anything you add has to come with an offset. What are you going to cut? What's a lower priority? And that's where I think there's the disconnect between the people who are thinking about strategy and the future of the military and then when they actually go to write something into legislation is they aren't identifying the offsets, the cuts that are going to make that future possible.
And when other countries, say Russia or China or who knows, look at what's going on, do they take the different accounts into account of their own in reckoning how to deal with the United States, do you suppose?
You know, I think we do a great job of confusing our adversaries. They've got to be looking at our political system, and it is probably pretty hard for them to make heads or tails of what's actually going to come out of it, because I think it's hard for us, and we live with this system. So, you know, I'm not sure what they take away from it. I think that they would be smart, our adversaries would be smart, to focus on our actions and not our words, and look at what actually gets funded, what actually gets done, what gets accomplished, and ignore a lot of the rhetoric, because a lot of the rhetoric really is just, you know, confusing and a distraction.
Todd Harrison is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Todd, thanks as always.
Thank you. Good to be on.